Good evening, everyone. My name is Miyoko. I'm one of the teachers here at the Village Zendo, and I see some completely new faces, so welcome. That's always really nice and a sign of health, so very good. And some people I haven't seen in a while, and that's really nice. And then some people I've just seen. The gamut, anyway. Welcome. So it's really feeling like spring is flowing all of a sudden. In the last couple of days in particular, you know, it's hard to pinpoint that exact moment of shift. You know, it's really like there is no isolated moment of shift. And yet, here we are, all of a sudden, the light is really different, the air is different, the sounds are different, flowers have grown, buds have sprung, and the energy is definitely not the same as it was, say, a month ago, March 10th, when chances are there was a blizzard happening. So this seasonal shift into spring is marked by two, you know, that I know of, probably many more. Actually, probably all of them, I'm just not aware of it, of the major religions, with traditionally very important periods of observance. Passover for the Jews, and of course Easter for Christianity. And while they're not the same, you know, I think there's a common thread. Both share a theme from different streams, but nevertheless, the theme is shared of rebirth or a quality of renewal through liberation. Again, the forms are different, but this is kind of a primary message I take from each. In the most literal sense, after the crucifixion, Christ is resurrected and liberated as he leaves his body and is reborn in the kingdom of God. And Passover celebrates the freedom of the Jews from slavery as a people in Egypt. So I am definitely not a Christian or a Judaic scholar or a theologian, and there's many infinite levels of interpretation of both of these themes. But again, on just a very fundamental level that I personally observe, I'll say that both bring us this profound message of possibility for liberation, renewal, a transformation in a very radical way in this life. That is the underlying thread of the Dharma in the Buddhist frame, that ongoing possibility of freedom available to us in each moment, actually. So our practice, you could say, is really an ongoing activity of liberation. Liberation from what, you might ask? From the prison bars that we have inherited, really, through all of our previous causes and conditions, which is unique to each of us, which is our own personal conditioning, our own karma, and which we habitually perpetuate. So this perpetuation, I'd say, continues and pervades so many aspects of our lives, largely because we are unaware of it, usually until maybe something happens. Often that something may be painful, challenging, unfortunately sometimes traumatic. But all of these times offer us the possibility to wake up, to see what is happening in a new way. That possibility is always with us, but often we don't stop and take notice until we're prodded to do so. I guess until we really experience suffering from how we're looking at things. On the most sort of gross, literal level, an example of this could be when I, a physical thing, which was, say, when I had gotten a frozen shoulder about a year ago. And this was actually one morning I woke up and I literally could not move my right arm. I couldn't move it, backwards or forwards, up and down, more than like an inch without just practically screaming in pain. It was so intense. And I'm a potter, so that was actually a really big deal for me. But this was actually the result of, though I woke up and one morning I couldn't move, it was the result of years of accumulated not actually paying attention to my body, particularly how I was working, but not only that. It was like a slow cooking crab, that the temperature goes up slowly, so you don't notice it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. I mean, all the signs are there, but just not reading them until all of a sudden, I was cooked and I couldn't move. So from the outside, and of course in hindsight, it was very obvious the train track that I was on. But while I was on it, this wasn't the case, because I didn't want to see the view, I didn't look. And so that train just really went off the tracks. And then I was really forced to reassess a lot of things in a completely different way. So ultimately, though, this is what really opened a window for me that I would not have otherwise opened. It really changed how I work, and it kind of illuminated to me the degree to which I was not paying attention to myself, not paying attention to my body, really disassociating and not listening. I was locked into a particular view and way of doing things, and I really didn't want to expend the effort, and it felt very threatening to change. So, this was something that in a way, especially because it's physical, was very externalized. And that's often easier to see, even as I wasn't seeing it. But Many of our prison bars are really difficult to distinguish. They kind of camouflage, blend into our internal landscape. And if we're fortunate, those bars are not literally metal or barbed wire. That which we can easily identify and see as being prison bars. But these bars are actually made up of all of our views, our habits, our deep-seated opinions, all of which shape how we see. A very common analogy many of you might have heard is, you know, that of like wearing a pair of glasses or lens through which we see and experience reality. And as long as we believe that pair of glasses we're wearing to be the way of seeing things, it's really limiting us in ways that we're not capable of seeing on our own, because we're the ones wearing the glasses. So this is why it's so important, for one thing, to practice in community, but that we look carefully not only inside by ourselves, but also at what is happening in our lives and around us. Because it's really full of signposts telling us, look here, if we choose to pay attention. There's always something there to see. As Dogen tells us, the truth is never hidden. So recently, on a more subtle level, I've become kind of acutely aware of the degree to which I can assume that something negative or something dangerous is going to happen. And this can be true particularly with people, with dynamics, with people. That in a sense, this is my default normal. Unless I have some external assurance otherwise, that is where I go. It's amazing that in 55 years I was not really cognizant to this trait, which actually colors many, many, many things. But once this was pointed out to me, and again, it needed to be pointed out to me from an external source. It's not something that I was capable of seeing on my own, because it's like the eyeball cannot see the eyeball. And since this has been pointed out to me, I've actually been, you know, trying to track this tendency to notice it whenever I can. And I should say that's when I remember to do it. And I'm finally seeing that there's actually really a pattern here. And the degree to which what I'm seeing is being colored by how I'm seeing. So, you know, this might happen in the course of 30 really simple, benign email transactions during the day. It's amazing what things one's mind can go through in terms of projection and interpretation and stunning, really. You know, so it's like perhaps this person isn't actually mad at me. Perhaps I'm creating this whole thing. And if so, then what I'm doing, what I'm coloring, is really changing and shifting a whole dynamic, a whole relationship. It's coloring a lot. So this perception might be causing me to, if I'm perceiving that I think somebody's mad at me, and just could be a flip tone, it could be somebody was really busy and they didn't have a chance to respond. You know, there's no telling what little thing might trigger such a reaction. But that trigger can then cause me to hold back. It can cause me to be withholding. It can certainly cause me to get extremely judgmental, extremely critical, cause me to get very tentative. There's any myriad number of ways that and roads I can begin to travel down, because fear or perceived fear can manifest and create a lot of unskillful behavior when I'm not aware that that's what I'm feeling. So it's very different when I can see it. So this is often what kind of creeps up when there's not really sure what's going on, and so I will overlay an interpretation on what I believe to be going on, which is very different than when I can actually get really in touch and see, oh, now I notice I'm feeling really uncertain, I'm feeling fear, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that. When I can see it, I can begin to have the space to really observe what's going on, first and foremost, inside myself. And then I can observe and, in a sense, have more choice and freedom and flexibility in my actions, how I'm going to respond or not respond to those feelings and really adjust them to what's actually happening. Not just inside my head, but what's in front of my face. Those two things can become much more aligned when we begin to see and have an awareness of the lens through which we're seeing everything. It is just so amazingly difficult and hard for us to look at what we don't want to admit is there. You know, we want and expect, actually, so much to be perfect. Much as on the surface, we don't say that, and we might not even consciously think that. But on some level, we expect ourselves to be perfect, to be good, to be right, to be cool, to be successful, to be many, 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 many different things. And we can feel a lot of shame when we suspect that this idea, this ideated self, is not real. And for many of us, this self-patrol, or now, after I've begun to frequent a couple of prisons, I realize it's like having an internal corrections officer on duty all the time, ready to step in, and it's like the self-punishment begins. And I realize that the tone of voice I can have inside my head with myself is not one I would ever use externally with another person. And it's exactly the same tone that I hear the guards using again and again at Sing Sing or at Bedford Hills. And when I hear it externally, I'm like aghast. You know, it's like I can't believe what I'm hearing. And yet I do this to myself all the time. So this is really where our Zazen, our work with the precepts, and that activity of atonement can all be very helpful. And in a way, those are all our practice meeting the activity of our lives. That's kind of where the rubber hits the road. Because when we do this, then we're really being present to what is happening. And we create the space with which we can actually hold and look at our behavior, at our actions that are causing suffering to ourselves, and by extension to others, because you can pretty much always bet that in some way, seen or unseen, what we're doing to ourselves is being externalized onto other people. So, in a sense, you know, we must open ourselves to our discomfort, to our awkward, imperfect self, so that we can really see and allow it to breathe and tell us whatever it is that it needs to say. We need to listen to and hear these voices inside. But we need to listen to them with the ears of love, not with punishment and not with denial and recrimination, but just, you know, the eyes of love, the ears of love. And the difference between hearing and listening to ourselves with compassion and listening and punishing ourselves with recrimination is a hair's breadth difference, but this difference in how we look and hear is the difference between compassion and utter disdain, and the difference between heaven and earth. And it's really important to see how you do that, because most of us go a lifetime just taking that to be how it is and how we are. So I found that over time, and I continue to find that this is actually how I truly heal, how that quality of reparation can occur, and how I actually free myself from very self-destructive and oppressive states of mind and behaviors. And so I think real change can occur in this softening to just what is, to make room for it. And this is often very humbling, and it can often be very sad and can be very uncomfortable. But ultimately, it is very empowering and very liberating. So again, I keep coming back to this, but you know, this has been such a sort of sore point in myself that I just feel compelled to, remorse again is very different from a knee-jerk self-flagellation, which believes it always knows what's right and what's wrong. And in a sense, is always looking to find that wrong. And I have seen in myself, it will find it, it will create it even if it's not there. You know, I may have had some situation go completely fine and I might feel really good about it for 5 or 10 minutes afterwards. But then it's like, oh, I can't just leave that alone and let something just be good. You know, I sort of need to go back in there and find, you know, how did I do something wrong when I was teaching that class the other day? Or, you know, how did I, you know, in some way, there's this quality of undermining. And I would say that this tyrannical, judgmental energy is just born. It's continually born out of our greed, our anger, and our ignorance. And so it actually perpetuates what it presents itself to be correcting. I mean, in a way, it doesn't really have our interests at heart. Our greed, our anger, and energy. Like, these are just, they're like primal energies that have this life of their own. So I really encourage you to inquire into the nature of that voice, whatever it sounds like or looks like in your own head. Who is this voice? Where does this voice come from? What does this voice really, really want? What is it actually doing as opposed to what it may be saying? Who is this voice judging? Really inquire into the nature of those voices that we take for granted. So we must each really bear witness to our own internal trial, so to speak. And in this way, we can bring light into the shadows, and we can really start to dissolve that quality of shame. So I'd say that this internal conflict is not very different from what plays out in the world, particularly in our criminal justice system, although often calling it criminal justice system seems like quite a stretch. This morning, Bill Keller had a very good editorial in response to Governor Cuomo's rescinding of his recent legislation granting educational funding to prisoners in New York State. So he actually rescinded this. And Bill Keller asks us to really look at the essential ambivalence we have as a society towards the intention or the purpose, really, of our criminal justice system. Is it to punish, which it does exceedingly well and brutally? Is it to keep the public safe? Or is it to rehabilitate? Not unlike our own voices that we may need to navigate internally. But so having spent some time in contact with the Department of Corrections, which is another paradoxical name, calls itself, I've witnessed a tiny, tiny degree to which our system is really locked into this mode of punishment. And this is increasing and getting more so. There's very little, any real even veneer or pretense towards rehabilitation anymore once you get inside the walls. And the punishment is actually so cruel and dehumanizing that I think many would call it torture if they were aware of what actually really goes on behind closed walls, where no light gets in. And it's a very, very, very rare few who manage to experience any rehabilitation or any positive transformation from this experience. And usually those people in some way, for whatever karmic reasons, do manage to get some sliver of educational programs or have, which is unusual in the prison population, links to the outside world from family, friends, politics, whatever. And that's about 0.5% of the millions of people who are locked up. But for those who are actually lucky enough to be given even some small modicum of care, fairness, and education, and programs for actual correction or rehabilitation is really one of the most beautiful and inspiring things in the world, to see how much is possible with so seemingly little. You know, it's like finding these beautiful flowers in the cracks in the sidewalk. And I would say that one of the saddest things in the world is the way in which those inside literally do not have a voice that is capable of being heard outside those walls. And so anything is fair game in there, because nobody can see what's happening. So I don't often do this, but I would really like to take this opportunity to encourage people to write Governor Cuomo to look at his policy on education and to refund the program, to not try to get private donors that he knows to give little modicums of money, but to refund the goddamn program and create more programs. you know, our prison system is such a deep, dark shame in this country. And we really must look at it because it's growing. And not only because it's the compassionate thing to do, and by extension, it is the wise and beneficial thing to do, but on a very pragmatic level, and we can see it in ourselves, what stays in the shadows only comes back to haunt us 100 times over. So people going into prison 9 out of 10 times come out 100 times more dangerous than they did when they went in those doors. And we have only to look inside our own minds to see this. And I will just, I can't help it, but I will throw in a little reminder that this would be a very opportune moment, should you feel compelled to write a letter to Governor Cuomo about this, rescinding of funding, to really just do the right and just thing and not bow to the loudest and the crudest voices asking for revenge and punishment with no redemption possible. To actually have the courage to reward rehabilitation and redemption when it does manage to happen against all odds. And I hope we all have this courage to hear all the voices and to then act. And should you write Governor Cuomo, I would put in a plug for Judy Clark, because I can't help it. And I will do this to my dying day. You know, who is so deserving of clemency, because she has managed somehow to do just that. After serving 32 years of a life sentence. So I thought I would end with one of Judy's poems, and it's called Out. And for those of you who don't know her, just because of time and everything else, that's another whole story, but there's information on her on our website, should you be interested. But this is a poem that she wrote. She wrote it quite a few years ago, but she says, I want to go out to a beach shadowed by windswept dunes, the ocean crashing, salt spray on my face. I want to run wild across bridges, heading from hard city streets to wide open spaces. Run till my lungs scream, my heart breaks, into a howling roar that thrills every fox, bear, coyote, orphaned fawn, she-wolf who's lost her young in this hunted, stripped, fenced-in land. I want to dance with fire. I want to float through waterfalls. I want to rub my face in pine-scented moss, hunt mushrooms under towering firs. I want to be free. So let's not take our lives for granted. Let's all bow to freedom.